Hyoid down, disarm legal, necromancer's mercy, said the second's necromancer calmly. Coronabeth sucked a breath through her teeth. Sextus, do you agree to those terms? I have no idea what any of that means, said Palamedes. Gideon drew forward to them, leaning in to hear Corona saying in an urgent whisper, Warden, that means she can hit your cavalier anywhere below the neck and it ends only when you give in. She's being an absolute cad, and I'm not even slightly sorry for pantsing her when we were 8. Nor should you be. Don't let her make an example of you, said the princess. She's picking on you because you can't fight back, like a bully kicking a dog. She's given herself leeway to hurt your cavalier very badly, and she will, just to scare Octokizeron and Nonagesimus. No offense, Ninth. The warden of the 6th drummed his feet on the floor percussively. He said, So you're saying her cavalier can do more or less anything to my cavalier, all in the name of making me cry uncle? Yes! From across the table, Captain Deutero said sternly, No more waiting. Default or fight. Corona, if you insist on arbitrating, then arbitrate. Those exquisite eyes would have persuaded a stone to roll uphill, but finding no purchase with Palamedes, Corona raised her voice reluctantly. To the mercy, call. Hyoid down, the neck is no exception. Point, blade, ricasso, offhand. Call. You can't hit her in the head, he said, I think. I choose when you're done. Just tell me how to play.
You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief, episode 23. Go Loud. We are so excited to welcome our friend Sid onto the show. Sid, I'm so glad you're here.
I'm so glad to be here.
So how did you get into the Locked Tomb? What is your relationship with this text?
I think it was my beautiful wife, Getty, whose voice you heard the last time we talked to the 6th, I think. I think she got into it first, and then she was like, babe, you gotta read this book. And then I finally read it when our power went out, and I was like, well, I got literally nothing else to do. And that's what I did. I did not regret it.
When was that?
Oh, God. That would have been in 2020 or 2021, one of the two. It was during lockdown.
And not long after Getty herself would have been reading it.
Yeah, probably not. And then I read the other books kind of as they came out.
We have seen some of Getty's cosplay. Do you kind of create in any ways inspired by the Locked Tomb?
I haven't cosplayed in a million years. I used to do Naruto cosplay, but it has been so long.
You did do Barry Star Gideon.
I did. Yeah, that's right.
Samesies! I haven't seen another Barry Star Gideon before.
It's great. I mean, why the fuck wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's real good. It's real good.
Yeah. I mean, I'm also a barista in real life, so I was like, well, it's obvious.
So from the top, Protessa Lawis is missing. We start on a cliffhanger.
Seriously.
because we fucking love cliffhangers in this series.
Tension high.
Tension high. Dulcinea is a bigger mess than ever.
Yeah, so she has been moved into a sick room near the priests, which is interesting. I kind of don't know why they didn't just put her back in her own room. Possibly it is hard to get to or something.
You know, maybe if her room were in a particularly drafty part of the castle or something like that. I don't think we ever get a description of her rooms.
I have a very different theory that I think you guys will agree with as soon as you hear it. It is for being able to reinforce her alibi now that Protessa Lawis is missing. If she is able to correspond her proximity with the teacher or the priests, she's able to control people's perceptions of her ability and what she's up to with a lot more credibility.
This is her idea.
I think it's her idea. And teacher would have no real recourse to say no, because she is literally the highest ranked person at Kanan House right now.
True.
Yeah.
She's created this situation. Why would her current circumstances be something that's like incidental and out of her control?
Hmm. Yeah.
I look at a lot more things now as like really clever social manipulation, looking at Kethereya now and looking at the way this book is written, because we quickly get into this really fascinating insight of teachers' necromantic awareness when he refers to the remains as plural.
Yeah, so we have this interesting scene. Obviously, we have identified this is the chapter with Go Loud, the big Cam fight. But before we get into that, there's this debate among the necromancers regarding these ashes from the incinerator. And there's so much happening socially here.
Yes. And, you know, the end of last episode's recording, we're very, you know, Jean Marie deserves better. And I do think that in this chapter, while she isn't given a lot of lines, she's given a lot of ferocity. She continues to not back down in terms of how she is responding to this situation in a way that I really appreciated, including in this scene. Because we are, you know, talking about the way that they treated Jean Marie at the incinerator was a big part of our last episode. And so we're still seeing her as a part of that conversation, though now they do have the necromantic expertise that whole previous chapter was kind of seeking. So this is the conversation that Jean Marie was and Isaac were hoping was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Everyone has absolutely agreed that these are human remains. One of the things that jumped out for me immediately was Coronabeth is not even pretending anymore. When the fifth died, she was absolutely getting in there. She wasn't spilling her blood, but she was totally pretending to be doing necromancy. And here, every single necromancer gets their hands all in the cremains. And she's like, why bother?
And not even just like, why bother? The word is disdained. Like, she has a negative relationship with the idea of doing so.
Having two like freshly dead bodies is in some ways a lot less disgusting than having a bunch of cremains, because those cremains, if you get in there, you're going to get that stuff all over yourself. So I think there's a much higher chance of like having to encounter something nasty. Whereas, you know, otherwise, if it's just the body, you could, you know, you can touch bits that aren't gross and stuff like that. So I think that has something to do with it personally.
Which is interesting for a necromancer.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, it's very telling about someone who would have a very sensitized reaction to human remains in general, mm-hmm. which a necromancer would be much less likely to have.
Oh, yeah.
Like, a necromancer would be, like, pretty fucking casual about remains. So the fact that Corona is like having a preference of distance.
She's been pretending since she was like five-ish. So yeah. I would guess that she probably doesn't have that kind of sensitized reaction. I'm sure she's very, very desensitized. And especially Ianthe's preferred magic is the grossest, in my opinion. Flesh magic is nasty, particularly compared to like bone magic, which at least is dry. So I would say flesh magic, clearly the nastiest, and she's been all up in that the whole time. So I really took this as like her deal with Ianthe broke in the last few chapters, and she's sort of not holding up her end anymore either.
Can I quickly take us on a fascinating and slightly body horror tangent?
Hell yeah.
Of course.
Bone magic isn't by necessity dry. It's just that we've only seen dry bone magic so far in this book.
That's true. Bones is where you make all your blood.
Bones are usually, for the beginning of their existence, quite wet. But when we also think about bone magic and Harrow's necromancy specifically, we have a specific sighting of wet bone magic in book two.
That's true.
True.
That's really wet bone magic.
Maybe I guess what I mean is wet magic is grosser.
That is understandable.
I personally would feel much more comfortable touching cremains because it's dry.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I'm suddenly imagining the difference between like a blend of leaves for tea versus like the stuff that collects in the trap of the sink.
Mm-hmm. I mean, now me personally, I probably wouldn't touch any kind of dead body willingly or for fun.
Would you touch a dead body to try to solve a murder, though?
I mean, yeah, obviously.
Like, they're not just like kicking it with the mystery corpse. They're investigating a murder.
Yeah, I mean, many people know this about me. There's nothing I love more than investigating a murder.
The other contrast is the things that are still found mundane, which is the idea of incinerating bodies is not actually as stunning. Like being like, oh, because they actually have a conversation with teacher of like, is this common practice here on Canaan House? Mm-hmm. Do you burn people in incinerators on the first? As if that's a normal question, which in some ways is totally reasonable. Like there's such distinct cultural differences between the houses, the idea that they don't actually have a strong grasp over what funerary practices might look like for the first is very plausible, but none of them are horrified at the possibility that this is a reality.
Except teacher,
who is like, no, no. And then we learn that he has some kind of sensitivity to cremains.
Yeah, because teacher just immediately knows that there's two bodies here and none of the necromancers had picked that up.
On my ongoing questioning of the design specs of teacher, why was that part of what was built into him? Because that's a really specific skill.
Yeah, I think that raises some really interesting questions about what he was for, because that is not a skill that you would need your house steward to have.
I just had a great idea.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Teacher, in his current role, is repurposed. He was built by John to help him with his research.
How?
I'm not a necromancer. I'm a sword fighter. I think that's a great question. But the idea that John wanted someone with unswayable loyalty and an extremely expansive set of necromantic sensitivities to help him in ways that he couldn't necessarily do, either due to safety or because he had to have plausible deniability, or like I could absolutely John seeing like, oh, I made Electo, or like even, you know, some of the technology that went into making Electo where it was a part of teacher's construction.
I think teacher was created by Cassiopeia and Nigella.
Okay.
But we know so little about early history.
That doesn't do anything to really disassemble the idea that he was made as a Mr. Handy research robot.
Or like a Mentat from like Dune or whatever. It's because it does seem like their computing equipment is fairly like rudimentary in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So, well, which also makes sense because John is not that smart. I don't think that John could build a computer by himself, but he could probably make a guy that can do a lot of things. So
I want to posit that a teacher was made partially out of necromancers.
Oh, that's so plausible.
Because he was made as part of the literal discovery process. And part of that process was figuring out how to put necromancers and calves in the same bucket.
Okay, my brain is now writing a fan fiction in which, like teacher is actually the God Emperor with Electo at his side. And this is a hilarious story in my mind.
I mean, that does get into, like, in what part of the body is the necromancy stored, you know? Like, how do you take the body of a necromancer? And what bits do you need to make a necromancer, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Is this a cellular thing? Is this an organ or like an organ based thing? Is this neurological? Like, is this part of some understanding of the body that we lack right now because we don't like metaphysically have an awareness of it? Like,
yeah, I don't know.
Well, it's definitely not certain parts of the brain if Hera was able to lobotomize herself and still be a lictor.
But it soul because it goes into Gideon when Harrow is in Gideon's brain. When Harrow is in there, Gideon can like see the thanergetic signature of the construct.
Mm-hmm. So we know that Sol does have a geographically, anatomically specific, like, preference, like, for nervous tissue. Because we also have descriptions later on of, like, what it feels like when Gideon's like, holy shit, Harrow, you're so weak.
Mm. Yeah.
So there's a kind of, like, embodied awareness, too, to the presence of the soul and the relationship between the soul and the body. So there's some really interesting things to deconstruct there. So, like, I think to me that says that nervous system is a core part of it. But that also might be a what type of necromancy are you doing question as well, where, like, if it's flesh magic, then there's a lot of different meat that might be relevant. Because, like, why would Ianthe be eating, like, fingernails if they were necromantically inert?
I want to know more about Ianthe's whole deal. And so does Harrow in this moment.
I love Ianthe so much. God, she's so gross.
Yeah.
Gross in a tender way. I'm saying that with love. A lot of love. Gross / positive. I love.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love
yeah,
it
sure.
When you're gross, you know?
It seems like in this moment, Gideon is noticing Harrow, noticing Ianthe holding a bone. And at least from Gideon's perspective, Harrow is like, oh, she's competent. Okay, hold on. And Gideon's like, not hold on. Stop holding on.
but also at the same time, like, maybe adding a little bit more detail to her creep factor feeling from Ianthe of like, I didn't like that bitch to begin with. And now Harrow doesn't like that bitch either, which, like, maybe cause for concern.
I didn't read it like that. I read this paragraph as Harrow loves a competent woman. And when Harrow sees a woman and notices that she's competent, her whole math changes immediately. And we saw that happen with Gideon when she was in the privileged position of feeling her fight. And we also saw that happening with Cam, where she changed how she related to Cam. Not in a, like, horny way, but she started being like, how come you're not like Cam, immediately after seeing how sort of put together Cam can be. And I think that she is seeing Ianthe notice which evidence is relevant and go, oh, you can hang. Oh, I think that that is, there's a level of, like, jealousy in how she's clocking that as well.
I can see it, but I would also say that Gideon herself is not actually aware of it.
Oh, totally.
Harrow is seeing something that is unusual and surprising about one of their peers. And instead of being like, that's hot, she's like, go on, which is Harrow's way of doing that, but is more effective at actually not getting them killed than Gideon's approach.
Is it?
You know what? Gideon dies either way. So then we have this conversation where, you know, different pieces of information are revealed bit by bit, and they conclude that one of them could not possibly be Protesilaus because they saw him recently, upright and moving, animate and alive. And they're so sure that it couldn't possibly be him because we saw him just yesterday.
Yeah.
He punched Octokesseron. So that means he couldn't have been dead.
Yeah. Oops.
Which is a big oopsie. Turns out, not mutually exclusive, punching Octokesseron and being dead.
One thing that I found really notable about this passage is teacher refers to the skeletons as my servants, which is a very humanizing way to describe them and is much more humanizing than the way Gideon talks about them or the other kind of house folks. And that seems really consistent with the fact that these skeletons are clothed and skeletons usually aren't. That, like, most of the people in the houses are used to thinking about skeletons as, like, not people. And teacher seems to be really understanding them, you know, not as his peers, they're servants, there's a hierarchical relationship, but in a way that still treats them like as persons.
Well, and they are, like, very much magically connected to him, right? Because don't they, if I'm remembering correctly, they all like disanimate, I guess, when he dies, right? So, I mean, once again, how come Teacher is so good at necromancy? Let's file that one away again. But like,
mass murder theory, bones might be left over. And if you were made of mass murder, the bones you would have a best connection with might be the bones that you used to have.
Yeah. It's 500 into 50. So there might just be more. I mean, they just might have chosen the 50 best bodies that they had. Their favorite 50 ones.
The 50 ones with the best bones.
The way that this series, like, injects eugenic thought into speculations never ceases to, like, both amaze and catch me off guard. Like, the concept of the best bones, mm-hmm. like, just the idea of that is, like, involves certain types of ways of valuing the body.
Yeah.
That mm-hmm. like, are not about living dignity.
No, we're not doing that. We're doing skeleton servants.
Yeah. Then Coronabeth pulls a Riker.
Sitting in a chair, weird.
Sitting in a chair, like it's like, hey kids, like,
I don't know. She almost seemed to be using the chair as like armor if she was feeling vulnerable in that moment. You know, which probably she would be. Then you know you're protecting all the squishy bits by having the chair in that. You know,
like yes, it's now physically protecting her, but also she's doing something that like socially might seem a little like. That's a lot of work you're putting in. Mm. Like we're sitting here looking at some ash and teeth and you're like, I'm going to move my chair around and I'm going to like move my body around it. Like, girl, like have a stretch break. I see that you're very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Well, and she is very much more physical than, I mean, obviously we know that she's not a necromancer, but like, I mean, I think that's another emphasis on how like rooted in her body she is, whereas the other necromancers definitely are not.
She's much more upset about the idea that Protesilaus might be dead, whereas the sort of real necromancers are mostly just sort of engaging with it as a puzzle. And Iante is, you know, aggressively impolite about the possibility because of who she is as a person.
Of which she clearly is aware and very comfortable with, defining herself not far further along as having a bad personality.
I thought that was a really interesting thing to say, actually. That doesn't sound like the sort of thing that you make up about yourself. That sounds like the kind of thing that you learn when somebody says it to you. And that makes me wonder who has been telling Iante that she has a bad personality, that she cares enough about that she remembered it and makes mm-hmm. jokes about it.
In that context, it might be a specific subtle jab at Coronabeth herself, because in the context of that line, she is disagreeing with Corona in public. So I could see that being specifically a like, you said this to me once and I'm going to weaponize it back against you, because that's what sisters do.
That's totally what sisters do. And everyone agrees that Corona is the one with the good personality.
Though in that context, I could also see that being like a weird like, royals and their parents thing. But either way, that's a what sisters do.
I mean, it also brings to mind like that thing that people say about other people sometimes when they don't want to talk about their competence or their looks. And she's like, well, she has such a good personality or whatever. And if someone were to describe Coronabeth, if they, you wouldn't necessarily, she's very competent, but you wouldn't necessarily, especially like her parents, wouldn't be describing like, oh, wow, you're so good at XYZ thing or whatever. They'd be saying, well, you know, Coronabeth's personality is just so great, you know. So, I mean, that could also be a jab at Coronabeth's personality.
Judith is really trying to be the adult in the room here, which she's not very good at and no one takes her seriously. But part of her doing that is describing the fourth as children, which I thought was really interesting, given some of the conversations we've had about the role of children in the military and how much responsibility we see children having over their houses. Like, it doesn't seem like the role of child is strongly differentiated in this culture, mm-hmm. but Judith does kind of like leverage it as an insult here, not an insult to the fourth, but as an insult to Babs.
I mean, that's one of those interesting things we talked about last time where like social class hierarchy play in the ways that we've been seeing a lot in the last few chapters have to do with being in the position to try and move those goalposts around who is respected and who is not around. Mm. Because that is explicitly a tool by which you can both blame someone and take away their agency in the same breath. The idea of being able to justify child soldiers while also being able to blame military successes and failures on a structure in which child soldiers are a key part, like, that's fucked up and very plausible in this world.
Yeah, that's true. And holding up the child soldier as a victim while also putting them out on the front lines is something that we see imperial structures do in real life all the time. Yeah. That, mm-hmm. yeah, that's a competent soldier when it comes time to putting them on payroll. But if anything bad happens to them in the newspaper, it's going to be a poor little teenager.
I mean, it's very much a, I can't believe they're making us do this type of a thing. And it's like, well, you're making you do this, actually.
And at no point has Captain Deuteros come to any aid of the fourth prior to this.
No, in no sense. They don't care at all.
Yeah. Like, there's a lot of like, you're just using this point so that you can tell Babs to shut the fuck up.
It's very copy, you know? I do like in the next line down where she says, well, this is where the tendon meets the bone. And I'm like, wow, I love that little phrasing. I just think it's fun.
Yeah, yeah, that's just a stock phrase for them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Judith posits that she is taking responsibility for the situation because nobody else has the stomach for it, which is not a good reading of what has been happening so far, but is a self-aggrandizing explanation for what she's about to do.
Yeah, and that self-aggrandizing is very appropriately responded to by Palamedes in the rest of this chapter, where like he points out just how empty that authority is. Like, what the fuck have they been doing? Have they been down in the facility doing anything according to the actual like requirements and expectations of the reason why they're fucking here?
So she demands that Palamedes hand over their keys, and he tells her to go fuck herself. And then we get into this duel, and Teacher is horrified. He is like, I can't even watch. And he leaves. And I think that's a really interesting reaction that nobody but Gideon seems to clock. And Gideon clocks it as like futile, as if that's going to stop anyone. But nobody has this moment of like, oh, hey, I think like we know that there isn't a rule against this, but maybe we aren't doing what's intended.
And you know, Corona's objections immediately kind of following Teacher's exit isn't, hey, notice the larger circumstances, but is, hey, this is not an honorable reason to be infighting. Mm-hmm. If we're going to infight, let's infight honorably. Corona's like main mechanism socially in this is playing off of those like subtle social bids that play between class and authority. Like, that's her specialty. And in every interaction, she's often in this kind of mediating and arbitrating role. Like, from the Cavalier duels early on, her understanding of social protocol and class interactions is the thing that she's constantly trying to use to gain advantage or gain control of a situation. Whether she wants to be in that position or not, it's still the thing that she reaches to.
So Corona and Ianthe overtly fight over Nibirius's loyalty here. And Corona is very surprised that she loses.
I mean, when I first read it, I was surprised. Like, I remember feeling shocked that this happened. And I mean, obviously looking back, you're like, well, obviously, but it is kind of like a slap in the face.
Yeah. You really don't think that that is going to be how it goes. I think partly because the narrative sets up Ianthe as so sort of repulsive that it seems like an obvious choice. Like, choose the beautiful, charming, good one, not the bad, yucky one.
But when you think about it as Babs is the only other one in on the secret, mm-hmm. it makes so much fucking sense.
Like, yeah.
He would put himself in immediate physical danger if he took Corona's side.
She's going to fucking eat him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, which this does him no good.
This does him no good, actually. Yeah.
Actually, capitulating helps nobody.
So they're, you know, they're all trying to de-escalate. They're like trying different bids for authority going on here. But this, the moment that Deuteros uses Camilla as a pawn in this conversation, Pal is done. He's like, we're fighting.
He's exhausted. He's so annoyed and so like disdainful through this scene. And he is not bothering to be polite or demure or any. He's like, I will follow the rules. We're all going to follow the rules, but I fucking hate you.
And the idea that he has to protect Cam somehow from Deuteros's own threat, like I'm going to threaten you, but don't get Cam in the middle of this. There's this part of me that in this moment, I love them, you know, Pal and Cam so much because of their just like profound respect and trust in each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's so powerful every single time it's touched on.
And like, Gideon notices that when the fight is called, Camilla's body relaxes. She has been characterized throughout as super sort of jittery and anxious and having all of this sort of nervous energy and movement. And right up until the fight, she is just totally at peace.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk about how hot it is that she just steps right the fuck up onto the table?
Yeah. Oh, buddy.
Ma'am.
This is also case v. case, which I'm very excited about. So it's rapier and knife versus rapier and dagger, which.
And I would almost say it's foil and like Bowie.
Yeah.
Like rapier and knife versus rapier and dagger paints a certain picture, but there's details here about Camilla's sword that not just kind of put it into the rapier category, which is a thin blade specialized for thrusting, but still capable of mm-hmm. cutting. Cam's blade looks more like something that is so specialized for thrusting that it really couldn't take a cut in a defensive way.
Yeah.
Like we have what is more like a modern Olympic fencing foil than something like a rapier, which is what Gideon is carrying. And the knife that Camilla is using is extremely unorthodox for using in this kind of combat scenario at all.
Mm-hmm. And that is not the sword that you would want for a sword and knife combination, because a lot of the way that you're going to use a sword and knife together is using the sword to tangle up your opponent so that you can get in with the knife.
Mm-hmm.
And if that sword is super lightweight and it can't handle taking an edge blow, you're going to be really limited in how you can use that. And so this is two weapons that Gideon perceives as having been really scrounged up, that they don't really go together. Mm-hmm. And Cam is already sort of making the best of some bad equipment.
And it to me, you know, it also implies like this interesting fighting style as a result of it, because using a heavier knife, to me, based on, you know, my own training, lends to a more aggressive, brawly style of fighting. And so if you're trying to find the agreement between a very lightweight, thrusting, exclusive sword that has a longer range and a heavy brawl forward knife, you're going to get some really weird shit happening, which, like, in terms of what Camilla does, is weird shit, but it makes her extremely unpredictable based if you have general conventional fighting, which is why we have this wonderful explanation of like Dias's background and training compared to Camilla's, compared to Babs's, mm-hmm. compared to what Corona might also be familiar with, like what Camilla is about to pull off, what she already has done. She is, among all fighters, both theoretical and real, somewhat extraordinary. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I do think it's really interesting how, like, at no point in this does Gideon go, oh, she's probably not best with a, like, with a rapier and knife. Like, that's probably not what she does, especially considering, of course, that, you know, that's not what Gideon does either. And I don't know. I just think it's a really interesting take of hers that, like, she doesn't even consider that. I mean, it does kind of emphasize to me Gideon's loneliness of just like, oh, I'm the only one here who's actually pretending to be a cavalier in like the typical way that cavaliers are.
The moment when she fights Cam early on, you know, kind of by accident, is a moment of connection for her. It's a moment of, oh, hot dang, this is going to be interesting. The relationship they could have as nerds who like swords, the conversations they could have under trying to pass off body mechanics as if their training had been different would be really fascinating. But like, as you say, the isolation that Gideon's experienced, there's a loneliness in her not recognizing someone who's having a pretty parallel experience to her mm-hmm. own mechanically with these weapons that feel weird based on what her body knows.
It does make sense, Camilla's strategy of moving very fast and closing as fast as possible, because she cannot cope with a lot of long curves that generate a lot of force. And so she needs to tangle up her opponent's weapon as fast as humanly possible.
And she needs to do it with what she has that's strong. Mm-hmm. Like she does most of her damage at close range. She doesn't really bother using the thrust of her long blade at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as she's going forward, her rapier is held wide and her butcher's knife is held close. So she's actually planning to do most of her defensive maneuvering with the butcher knife, not with the rapier.
Which does make sense because it is structurally a lot more sound.
Totally.
But like, it tells of a kind of risk taking that, like, to be a good fighter and to take risks like that, like, your risk evaluation has to be really, really, really good. Because she's not got a lot of protection. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, this knife is held in close. It's tight to her body. She can respond to it quickly. But it's small. It can't cover a lot at one time. It has to be where it needs to be, when it needs to be there.
And she is fighting with right hand, left hand, and at least one foot. Her whole body is on the attack.
Yeah, I love how they describe her fighting style as being like a grease fire. It was very evocative.
Yeah, because a grease fire, you know, strikingly is hostile to being extinguished. Mm-hmm. So anything you're throwing back at it, if you're not very, very specific about what you're throwing back at it, it is going to get worse fast. A quick safety PSA, if you're dealing with a grease fire, don't throw water on it.
Sure.
You want to either use a fire extinguisher or some kind of flame retardant blanket.
This would also be my advice for dealing with a case fighter, if at all possible. So Camilla ends this fight by pulling her arm out of socket.
I mean, it's kind of the move that people always talk about when they talk about like sword fighting. Just like, oh, what? Why don't you just pull out a gun? It's like, yeah, just like fucking dislocate her arm, actually. That's going to be fastest.
Yeah, and when someone's sword is in your forearm, you know exactly where their wrist is.
True. Mm-hmm.
Because, like, if I, you know, I'm sitting here reading this, imagining someone's sword having aimed for my collarbone, caught my forearm. So I have some number of inches of swords through my forearm meat right now, which means that my hand is very close to their hand. Mm-hmm. And I don't need a fucking sword anymore. It's not going to do me any good, but you know what'll do me good? You in excruciating amounts of pain. Like some of the choreography in these fights are just so, so telling about the difference between different types of people and fighters. Mm-hmm. like the rules around different types of combat in different social scenarios and how different people can train for different types of scenarios and become very different decision makers. Like Babs could never.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Camilla also, you know, getting up on the table seemed like it was showboating, but she was planning to use the space to corner her opponent. And that was an essential function of how she managed to pull this off.
Mm-hmm. Which makes me wonder about her training and about her experiences applying her training prior to this. Like, is she some sort of like I'm getting some sort of weird like Indiana Jones scenario where like, you know, Palamedes is out there like collecting documents and manuscripts in like high risk environments and Camilla's like fighting off traps and bad guys. Like, I don't know, but it's like the kind of experiences that would lead to someone being very proficient at this whole situation. One, using the table strategically, and two, using her forearms strategically to both catch and defend thrust and also get into someone's guard for a dislocation. Like, this she's not new at this.
Mm-hmm.
Where has she been doing these things that she's really relaxed doing this? And the fact that Pal knows that, he's seen her do this before.
One of the things that we know about the Sixth is that it seems like it's a very cramped environment. So, I mean, yeah, it makes sense that she would be better at getting right up in someone's guard and certainly better at fighting in a more cramped and closed in environment than someone who is used to fighting like on a battlefield, for instance.
Yeah, I think that the Indiana Jones question is apt as well. And Indiana Jones also has some colonial implications that don't fully hold up on inspection.
Yet again, the theme of, well, we have characters that we like, but when we look at them in the context of what they represent within the space imperial structure, we like them less over time. I love Campal, but just knowing what they get up to prior to this, like to get to this point and how they function as a hand of the Empire, like, boo. Yeah, the Indiana Jones thing to me, I think, has a lot of reusability in terms of examining the way that Palamedes interacts with the world, like both physical environment and relationship to his own entitlement.
Tamsin has a lot of unexpected language that she uses, which I really like. And an example of that in this scene is the dislocation being described as a bright pop. It's just like, oh, what a weird and terrible word to use there. And I love it.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at some language not far after that I think also does that, which is Lieutenant's tiny half-amazed gasps. You know, Camilla's just coming down from doing this, but both the Lieutenant and Jean-Marie are like, holy shit, that just happened. Like, I feel like Dias, even though she just had her face smashed into a table and had her arm pulled out, she's like, damn, girl! Like, there's this mutual respect between the fighters and recognizing each other's capacity that seems to be a recurring theme every time it's Cav on Cav, except if Babs is involved.
Yeah.
Where they're just like kind of nerding out over each other's ability in a way that I find very heartwarming and relatable.
Mm-hmm. Also, hot dog. What an icon.
What an icon.
She's like, so baby.
Legend icon.
And she has like in the Moira Quirk voiced audiobook, she has a French accent. So just imagining like hot dog, like just this, like it's even funnier to me because of that little affect.
I love how absolutely fucking over this Palamedes is. I find him really charming in this scene. Yeah. I don't know if there's a rest of that thought. I just find him really charming in this scene.
Once again, the cop-ass attitude of like, ah, no, rules for thee, but not for me. Of like, well, I don't have to give you my key, actually. And it's just like, no. Fuck you. I just beat your ass. Like, get out of here.
Yeah, it's like Judith didn't think that she might lose, obviously, because she didn't think that was possible. But now that she has lost, she's still imagining that what's going to happen is she doesn't win. And he's like, no, you lost. You have to do lost now. And I love that he's like, no, it's not because I benefit from it. I don't benefit from it. It's because it's stupid.
Mm-hmm. And he also takes this moment to voice and articulate the social destruction that has occurred as a mm-hmm. result of this. And like, because he didn't think this was competitive. He didn't come into this competitively. He has actually been looking for collaboration mm-hmm. basically throughout the entire book so far. Like, yes, he keeps some things to himself, but he's not had an overtly adversarial relationship in a way that so many of the other houses have. And he's also like expressing how destructive this type of violent adversarial nature is in terms of their entire objective. He's like, you have changed the game and the rules in a way that puts us all in danger. Mm-hmm.
At the same time, most of what he says to complain about her is not in those terms. It's like he kind of struggles to get the words around what he actually means, because what he talks about at first is, you haven't been paying attention. You don't know how many keys everybody has. You don't know how good Cam is at fighting. Like, I just hate people who make assumptions. But that isn't the problem that he has with the situation. Mm-hmm. That is like the norms of the sixth. And he's like, you're not doing it good. But he eventually gets to like, hey, you've undermined everyone's safety. And that's his real concern. But it takes him a while to get there.
Yeah. And we've talked a bit before about how like questioning the larger set of factors that have led them to this place, this situation, the dynamics that they have, is something that not a lot of the characters are given an opportunity to. And we specifically talk about this in relationship to Gideon's relationship to power. But we're also seeing maybe a little bit of Palamedes' relationship to power, because he has been in this situation where it's been forced upon him to really have to experience the violence of that power being applied and the idea of that hierarchy and how that hierarchy should be being enforced within the heads of the houses, who generally, I would imagine, would not be the recipients of the enforcement of the hierarchy of the empire. And now suddenly he is on the receiving end of it and he's like, it's all bullshit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And is dangerous for everybody.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's almost like there's something to say here about, you know, the way that our society works or whatever. I don't know. Probably it's nothing, you know. I do like also that Marta is the one who eventually does give up the keys. Judith doesn't back down.
It is really interesting, though, within the power structure that we've discussed before, that he is asking another necromancer for the keys, even though both of them know that the Cavaliers are the ones who hold the keys. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And even, you know, being curious about why the Cavaliers are the ones that hold the keys, because that was part of the initial framing from Teacher, which mm-hmm. means that it was probably part of the initial framing from John. Mm-hmm. Or was it someone else's design? Like, it sets up a really interesting dynamic over who is supposed to have a certain type of power mm-hmm. in a way that is making a little bit of a check and balance type mechanism emerge.
Yeah, it kind of seems like having the Cavaliers have the keys stops the necromancers from going into the basement by themselves, which, you know, isn't what they're supposed to be doing.
When you start to scratch back some of the layers of this and see the power structure stuff under this, like it starts to feel bad and you're like, oh God, space empire with necromancy is horrifying. But this moment here feels like one of the few really clear ones where there's a different energy than mm-hmm. just simply being participants in this system. That's one of the reasons why it's like really easy to like this version of Pal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like his deeply righteous anger.
I think also that this scene is especially, I feel like it hit harder as I kept reading the book. Like, the more times I read the book, the better it got. Kind of, and, you know, that could just be that the whole book is growing on me every single time I read it. Or it could also be, it does feel a little bit like we're in this situation that he's describing. In some ways, we're living in a world where the social fabric has been torn in such a way that we're all sitting here, anyone who is like Pal and going, what the fuck, is sitting here and going, can this ever be repaired? Can it ever be fixed? You know, not to get heavy or anything, but
a bit of left grief there for you.
Yeah.
But and I think, you know, asking those questions in partnership with the kind of anger mm-hmm. at the situation that felt like it was unnecessary to bring it to such a violence, to acknowledge that maybe this is not a safe moment that we're in. Mm-hmm. You know, this didn't have to be revealed through putting each other into harm's way.
I think that Pal's frustration and rebelliousness is seeing that it's less that the social fabric has been torn and more that this sort of is the natural result of the society as it's been constructed. That true. That this is coming up because Judith is leaning into playing soldier rather than leaning into her friendships, because she does have relationships here. And she, you know, Corona is constantly being like, hey, remember how we hang out? Remember birthday parties? Remember that time I pantsed you? And Judith is like, no, I'm a soldier. I do not have pantsed memories. I do not go to birthday parties. And so like, it is her leaning into the structure that's causing her to be a dick.
And I think that also, again, contributes to that feeling of isolation from Gideon, because, of course, she is largely completely fucking out of this entire social structure. So it's just like, even more, every single time that someone references the way things should be or the way things normally are, it's, again, something completely, you know, alien for Gideon. Not just because it's on a different planet, you know?
Yeah. Camilla is almost like apologetic about how this fight went and the fact that she got wounded, and frames it as like, I'm not making excuses, but she was quick as hell. And Palamedes is almost like impatient with her that she didn't do better in this fight where she absolutely kicked ass.
Mm-hmm. There's that, remember that you're using a rapier, please. Which, again, if Gideon was thinking just a little bit harder, just maybe a little.
This kind of reminds me to the how Silas talked to Cullum after Cullum's soul got back.
Yeah. Also, we know that Palamedes doesn't know anything about swords.
Yeah.
He's being a little bit of a jerk.
He's being a little bit of a jerk. Sid, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Where else can people find you on the internet?
You can primarily find me through the podcast Resting Glitch Face. It's a Shadowrun actual play that's mostly women. And I am a cast member as well as the editor and producer. So it's my baby. Please go listen to it.
As someone who doesn't edit our podcast, this is my request to all of you who listen to podcasts to really take note and appreciate the production and editing that goes into these things. It's labor intensive, and it is one of the things that makes people like me sound cool.
Don't take too much note. Please. It's fine if you take a regular amount of note of the production values.
If you notice the production values too much, it means I've done my job incorrectly. What a delightful and gratifying and thankless job, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It feels good when you do something well and then no one will ever know about it.
Yeah. Hey, hon, I know about it.
Hey, Sid, I know about it too.
Damn.
Nun Pod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Kaylee and edited by Han Kaylee. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Our cover art was provided by guest Sid. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's nunpod.com. Remember to check out the stuff in the episode notes. Hey, thanks for listening.